Okay. Hi, Melinda. How are you?
I'm good, Michelle. How about you?
Good. So I guess we're supposed to introduce ourselves. I'm Michelle Goldberg. I'm a writer. I publish in lots of different places. The American Prospect, sometimes The Nation. I've written for The New Republic. I've written for Slate. Mostly I've been focusing on writing books for the last couple of years, and I have a new one coming out in April called The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, which is here. You can see it in front of the camera.
I wish I could see it.
I actually always think that these blogging heads things would be...
It'd be much better if we could actually see each other.
If we could see each other, yeah.
And I'm launching a new online magazine that's going to be called politicsdaily.com, and we're launching in April, God willing. So I'm very busy getting that ready.
That's so exciting. Like, one of the... I mean, there's so few media things being born instead of dying.
Well, I know. It is pretty exciting. Our my one-sentence mission statement is that we're going to do old-school journalism in a sustainable format with a respectful tone and a polypartisan point of view. So we're betting that there is a reader out there who doesn't necessarily want to hear screamed sound bites and who wants something maybe a little more thoughtful, sort of a slow blog approach.
So are you going to be also doing kind of investigations?
We will be doing some investigative stuff, yes. So I'm actually hiring, which is kind of amazing.
Wow.
Right
oh
now.
Oh, my God. You must have, like, people beating down your door.
Well, it's great to be able to float a few lifeboats, that's for sure. And, you know, what great talent is out there, unfortunately.
Right.
So we're going to talk about Kathleen Sebelius.
That's right. And you said when we were emailing each other that you could kind of understand some of the objections.
Well, what I meant is that I am a big supporter of Kathleen Sebelius. In fact, I was sort of rooting for her all along. That's easy to say now that she's finally been chosen the third time around. But I think that the interesting thing here is how few objections are really being raised. And I saw where the Family Research Council has put out sort of an outraged statement saying, where's the anger? Why aren't Republicans more up in arms about this?
And Sam Brownback is supporting her.
Right. And I think the reason for that is that she has actually done what Obama, quite wisely in my view, talked about doing, which is reducing the number of abortions in her state. I mean, she really put a lot of support into adoption. She really paid a lot of attention, I think, to family planning. And she, you know, did what I think we could all agree is the goal, is reduce the number by 10%, which is really an accomplishment.
Right. Although, how much of that do you think is attributable to her and her programs?
I think you could argue that it was a major focus. I mean, did she single-handedly accomplish that? That would never be the case.
You don't think it was just... I mean, abortions in general have been going down.
Right, but I think 10% is pretty high,
pretty dramatic.
And that she was pretty relatively involved mm-hmm. in these programs and really was the impetus, really pushed through, particularly the support for the adoption programs and tax credits for people who were adopting. You know, in this economy, unfortunately, I think we're going to lose some ground all around no matter what we do, because when the economy's bad, the numbers always goes up. But I actually don't quite understand
it. Maybe you know more about this. The idea that, like, tax credits would spur adoption, because you're not giving tax credits to women for going through with an unwanted pregnancy, right? You're giving tax credits to people who adopt. But it seems like there's such a market. There's such a, you know, people are desperate to adopt. I mean, you have so many stories all over the world of, you know, babies being basically kidnapped and put on the international adoption market.
That's right.
There's these huge waiting lists. I guess I don't understand how these programs work. It's not like you have to spur people to adopt.
No, I think you have to provide actual support to women who might make that decision if they had the support. Mm-hmm. So it's both things. That's absolutely true that there's no shortage of people, and I don't think has been for many decades. No shortage of couples who would love to have children and would love to adopt. But it's providing a supportive, you know, it's walking the walk and really supporting the women who are in that situation. And, you know, when you can pull that off, I love that that's the new focus. And I'm so happy with all these common ground initiatives, really looking at supporting women, because that's, we're never going to agree on the other. And that's why I also agree with Kathleen Sebelius that, you know, having all the focus on Roe, whatever your feelings about abortion, has been a losing strategy. We're not going to get anywhere with that. And I don't think, you know...
A losing strategy for who?
For pro-lifers. I mean, to make it all about Roe versus Wade has only led to 35 years of fighting. And has only, you know, it's filled coffers on both sides, but has it really helped women and children? I don't think so. So I would say as the more that we can keep the focus on helping women who need it and on reducing the number, then the better off we are. Because as Doug Kmeek said in Slate, you know, even if Roe v. Wade were overturned tomorrow, do we really know that that would reduce, you know, the number of abortions by even one? It would go to the states. So I don't think that's clear at all. And so I very much agree with her focus. I also understand the opponents who say, well, look, she's hung out with this, you know, very prominent abortion doctor, this George Tiller.
George Tiller.
But, you know, guilt by association hasn't worked that well recently. It didn't work against...
Well, and I would say, I mean, you know, as somebody who's very strongly pro-choice, I mean, well, first of all, she hasn't really hung out with him, right? He won in an auction a right to attend a reception
right.
with her.
Right, right.
So that's different than...
Right, point taken.
I mean, but personally... I actually feel like somebody, I would actually like somebody who would defend George Tiller against the craziness of Phil Klein. I mean, George Tiller is a doctor who, one of the things I think about the incredibly polarized and dangerous situation for abortion providers is that the people who end up actually willing to do this are inevitably kind of the most militant, the most stubborn, right. the most kind of pugilistic, you know. Right. So I understand that a lot of these figures are not, you know, necessarily the best kind of spokespeople for the movement. But at the same time, George Tiller is a person who is, who's been a victim of kind of almost continuous terrorism and a level of kind of legal harassment that would be unthinkable for anybody in any other profession. I would like to see as a person who's kind of dedicated to upholding the law, to see somebody who would be willing to stand with him.
I don't think you're going to see that from a politician any more than you saw, you know, Barack Obama wanting to stand with William Ayers.
Well, I guess that's the thing. I wouldn't associate George Tiller with William Ayers.
Well, I think he could have, Obama could have said, this is a guy who's really distinguished himself in education reform. I think would that have been the courageous thing to do? Probably, but it wasn't the political thing to do. And I don't think you're going to see that. But I also don't think that this kind of, as I said, guilt by association works. For example, look what happened to Elizabeth Dole and Kay Hagan. I mean, I think people really have had it with that kind of political attack, and it doesn't seem to be sticking to civilians at all.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting,
so
I wonder why this is why there has been no, that I can see, kind of questioning of her in the feminist movement or in the pro-choice movement, even though there's a lot of unhappiness about some of this abortion reduction strategy, not all of it. I think the pro-choice movement generally, some of it just irritates them because they feel like this is what they've been doing all along, not necessarily in terms of the adoption part, but in terms of pushing family planning. You know, anybody who goes for an abortion is inevitably counseled on contraception and how, you know, not to get in that situation again.
It's true that they've been doing that all along, and they deserve a lot of credit for that, probably more credit for that. I think it's a question of emphasis, and it's also a question of tone. And tone matters a lot. And I heard somebody the other day say, you know, why would anyone object to Kathleen Sebelius when, you know, did they think that Barack Obama was going to choose someone who wasn't pro-choice? But I think what people who want to see the number of abortions reduced would say is that tone matters a lot, and understanding and compassion for the other point of view. You know, just realizing that we're not going to agree on this, but wanting to look at where we do agree rather than to have the fight, I think it makes a huge difference.
I think there does seem to be a lot of worry that I sense among, or if not worry, irritation among pro-choice people that abortion is being painted as something. So, I mean, I think that everybody agrees that nobody wants to have an abortion, but the idea that it is something that has to be avoided at all costs, that we should always assume that a woman who carries her pregnancy to term as opposed to terminates it is making the right choice, that that's the choice that society should be pushing her, even though we're going to kind of allow it if she makes the wrong choice. I think people worry that there's a re-stigmatization of abortion, which is, you know, clearly what people, that's actually in certain ways where the country is.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, I mean, it's interesting that it has, you know, it is becoming, there's kind of two parallel consensus, it seems to me. There's a consensus about we're not going to get very far by making it illegal, which is something, I mean, which is kind of, it's amazing to me having reported this book, and I'm having this weird feedback thing, and I can't tell if people watching this are going to be able to hear it too. But, you know, one of the things when I was reporting this book, I went to countries all of, and the book is about population control and sex selective abortion and kind of the UN and the UN's attempts to promote women's equality and the kind of unintended consequences that you get on the grassroots in societies that aren't, you know, very amenable to women's equality at all and see it as a form of imperialism. It's about all these different things. But one of the things I saw going to country after country where abortion is illegal, and there's, you know, still quite a few of them, is that there's just no correlation between whether abortion is illegal and whether it's common.
Right.
I mean, just none.
Right.
And, so,
and that's where you see how our
that
strategy has
the,
failed.
What's that?
That's how you see how we failed. You know, we should have done a much better job if we hadn't been fighting all these decades. If we had been paying attention to caring for people, we surely wouldn't see the high rates that you have in the country.
Right. If we had said, you know, American women deserve a system like the women have in Holland.
Right.
Where they have, you know, very, like, excellent health care, excellent a social safety net, and very low abortion rates because they don't need them.
And maternity leave and all sorts of supports for mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which is actually, that's a whole other part of the story, too, which you see in, you know, kind of in some of these. There's also another debate that's kind of tangentially related to this when it comes to the right being in this kind of uproar about, or not uproar, but maybe panic about low birth rates in Europe.
Right.
And this idea that we are, you know, that the death of the West and, you know, Europe is going to give way to Eurabia because women are too selfish to breed and, you know, feminism is kind of leading to the death of civilization. And it's so interesting because you actually have pretty high birth rates in all the countries that do provide kind of a rich array of services to support working women, like Sweden and France and Denmark.
And that shouldn't be a surprise, and that should be a strong argument for us.
Well, I think that one of the reasons it's not a strong argument for us, and this is something I argue in this book, is that I think that people on the left in general, you know, as most feminists are, have been really reluctant to even talk about this birthright thing because it seems to smack of eugenics.
Mm.
You know, nobody wants to, especially after many, many years of talking about overpopulation and population control, which is also something that's a real issue. Who wants to say, oh my God, it's a terrible, horrible problem that women in the developed world aren't having enough children? You know, or that kind of immigration in Europe is going to become unsustainable. I think, you know, and I actually started this book maybe thinking that a lot of this stuff about the birth dearth and, you know, a lot of these alarmist books about Europe, which the right, you know, churns out at this kind of dizzying pace, were just based on fear of immigration and, you know, kind of xenophobia. But it really is a real, real problem. You know, some, like, you can't have Italy. I think I've read somewhere that Italy, if its birth rate stays what it is now, it's going to be 14%.
Well, that's very interesting. Having lived in Italy, I mean, there is a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment there. And so that is a huge issue for them. But, so on the one hand, they've done very well in, I mean, I think they have a pretty low abortion rate because they have a lot of access to family planning.
Right, but they also just have
control.
A low birth rate.
Right. But that's a sign of their success, and yet they're terrified at losing Italian culture.
And I actually think that that's a valid fear. Mm. I mean, right, you can't have, I mean, if they're going to have a
It's pretty ugly when you experience it, though. It might be a valid fear, you know, to lose your culture, but there are some pretty ugly aspects to what
that really
means. You know, when it's particularly anti-Muslim, mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, it's not pretty. And there's this clinging to Catholic culture, even though that's what they, you know, that's what they'll tell you, even though these are, you know, it's also a pretty secular country
right.
in terms of actual church attendance. They still want to have the cultural attachment to the church.
When did you live in Italy?
I was there from 01 to 03.
Oh, so at such a time of, like, upheaval. And...
Right. Right.
But here's what I think is interesting, is that, no, I'm not trying to defend this kind of crazy nativism and this rise of, you know, these kind of quasi-fascist parties in all these countries. It's more just that I think that that's an inevitable... Like, for example... You know, I think Germany, in order to maintain its current population, would need something like, it would need to replace like 84% of its current population with immigrants. Or there's some numbers that it would basically need to become a country that's 84%, you know, foreign born if it wants to maintain a stable population 100 years hence. I should double check these numbers. They're all in the book and I'm probably mangling them.
But if these countries became more of the melting pot that we are, would that be so tragic? I guess that's the question.
Well, no, it wouldn't. And just but the other part of that is that, and they should, and they have to. I mean, they're going to have to adjust to much higher levels of immigration than they are now. And you know, countries like Germany have to kind of change their whole conception, I think, of Germanness.
Or France. You look at what they're going through with what's French.
But the thing is that. The countries that are able to do that, that are able to make more successful transitions, are seem to be the ones that already have a little bit more confidence in their own cultures. In the countries that really feel like they're kind of shriveling and dying are the ones that seem to be the most prone to these really intense nationalistic movements, mm-hmm. whereas the countries that have somewhat kind of robust birth rates and actually France, even though it's having all these growing pains and it has, you know, Jean-Marie Le Pen, also seems to, you know, you do see people of North African descent moving into the government. There's at least some recognition that France is going to have to be a multicultural society, unlike,
right.
you know, Germany, where... You still have all of these people who aren't, you know, all of these, you know, people who've been there for generations who aren't even German.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't even, and can't become German.
Right.
So I just, what I think is so interesting is that they have to make these transitions, but the more they feel like, the more these transitions are made from, you know, kind of a position of vitality and growth as opposed to, you know, a kind of shriveling population that needs a huge influx of foreigners to support their pensioners, which is also not really a sustainable situation, the more easier the more easy this transition is going to be. So how do you, and what is fascinating is that if you look at all the research that hasn't really been popularized, there's this pretty direct correlation between patriarchy and social conservatism in, like, developed countries and low birth rates. You know, so the women in Italy are having very few children in part because, or in a large part because, both because there's not a lot of support for working women. There's not a lot of support among, you know, their husbands are still kind of retrograde.
I think they have a low birth rate in Italy because they have a very high standard of living. I mean, in the main, I think that's their choice.
But how do you then compare that to the fact that their birth rate is so much lower than Sweden or Norway or Denmark or even France?
I think that it's actually that they've gotten, it's a paradox for sure, in that they're on the one hand desperate to cling to the accoutrement of Catholic culture, and they have so detached from it that I don't think they see, you know, they really see small family as a status symbol. I don't know, the women I knew in Italy didn't want to have more than one or two children. So I think it's a choice, and I think, you know, there's no stigma to birth control. That's what I've had such a problem with here is, and I will never understand how you can say you oppose abortion and oppose, you know, access to birth control. I think that's crazy. I think that, you know, all these Bush-era policies that restricted the access to birth control have to lead to more abortions. That's just, there's a clear line between those two.
Well, and don't you think, though, it's because it's not really so much about abortion, it's about this whole kind of package of social mores that it seems to represent?
Not for everybody. I really understand that thinking, and I think in some cases it is. But there are people who really believe that life should be protected and who really see that as a human rights issue. And it's so, for some people, it's sincerely not a power struggle. It's sincerely not about keeping women in their place.
No, I understand that there are people of goodwill who find abortion appalling, or find it tragic, you know, or find it unacceptable. And, you know, and one of the kind of difficult things about this being so polarized, and I've talked about this with other people, is that obviously almost everybody can relate to there's a lot of pressure if you have been pro-choice, and, you know, if you've been like me, someone who has been involved in pro-choice activism, you know, since I was a teenager, basically, because I grew up in Buffalo, where the clinics came under siege when I was in high school. And I used to go and do clinic defense, you know, before homeroom. One of the doctors whose clinic I used to stand out in front of was murdered.
Oh, my.
And, you know, so it was, you know, kind of my introduction to politics. It was, you know, probably the formative event of my entire life. And, you know, at that age, you'd say, you know, you kind of adopt the very militant rhetoric. It's just a clump of cells, you know, get your rosaries off my ovaries, etc. You know, obviously, as you get older, you know, I see my friends' ultrasounds and coo over them and, you know, and personify them. And, you know, so obviously you understand that there is something of value there, and that it's been very difficult for people in the pro-choice movement to talk about the fetus as having any value because they feel like that's like a slippery slope to, you know, The Handmaid's Tale.
Right. But, and on the other side of that, people who really can't see it as other than a person, and to be constantly seen as someone who hates women is very difficult too. So that's why I say the rhetoric matters so much. And I understand what you're saying about the re-stigmatization, but there's a lot of stigmatization also of people who have always just wanted to see a reduction and don't want to have fighting and don't would never agree with, you know, violence toward somebody on the other side of the issue.
But when I said before, though, that I think it's about, a lot of it is about, a lot of it is, you know, that the reason that so many people oppose both contraception and abortion is because it's more about a question of social mores and what a society tolerates.
Right.
You know, one of the things I've seen around the world, with the Catholic Church in particular, is an obsessive focus on what's legal as opposed to what's happening. So that, you know, in a lot of Latin American countries, there are incredibly strict abortion bans, but only in a couple, like El Salvador and now Nicaragua, are they really, really enforced. You know, in many places you have abortion bans. You also have clinics that everybody knows about that, you know, as a foreigner, was able to find out about, you know, within a matter of days, if not, or weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real protest about the existence of these clinics that are totally well known. There's no, you know, there's no activism against the fact that abortion is happening. The only things only kind of come to life when somebody tries to create some legal sanction for it.
Well, that's not just on abortion or anything related to that. That's, you know, the Catholic Church always looks at the ideal. They don't necessarily look at, you know, they want to tell you how it should be, not how it is.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how their policy works on absolutely everything. So it's not just this. And it's just very difficult for people who do have a genuine, you know, I don't think heartbreak is too big a word to use, over this happening, this loss of life, to be constantly seen as someone who hates women and wants to control them and keep them in their place. And I have no doubt that for some people that's true, but for some it's really not. And that's why, you know, I would just love to see this unhooked from, on a policy standpoint, from, you know, others who would like to see the number of abortions reduced, see it unhooked from all the family planning stuff, because that just seems so destructive and counterproductive.
Does that exist as an organized movement? Is there any kind of organized lobby that is anti-abortion and pro-family planning?
I think a lot of people are. I mean,
yeah, that seems to be, no, it's definitely a position, but I just mean, is there...
Well, is the lobby,
do they have representation?
You know, I think the lobbies on both sides traditionally have been pretty extreme. I mean, I've written about this before, but something that so turned me off to both sides on this issue and really kind of crystallized my own thinking on this was, I was covering the Senate was voting on partial birth abortion, you know, maybe 10 years ago. And so women on Capitol Hill, women in the Senate and the House, were, you know, having sort of dueling press conferences on their positions. And they, of course, both sides had brought children as props. And so here were these, I completely believe, well-intentioned women, completely sincere in their belief that they were doing the right thing. It was a super hot day. These kids were uncomfortable as hell. They were crying their heads off. And I thought, this is the perfect tableau to explain what's wrong with this whole debate. Here are these nice women I like on both sides, oblivious to the fact that the kids they say they're here to protect are in misery.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, they can't hear each other talking. You know, I'm so happy to see the small steps that have been made recently in trying to focus. I just don't think we're ever going to get anywhere except, again, raising tons of money for both sides for political purposes, but it's not helping women. And that's why I really am not a fan of the lobbies on either side of this debate. And I would say that on the pro-life side of the debate, you know, when you say, is there any organized, you know, move toward what I'm talking about of also pushing family planning, you know, that's certainly a commonly held position, but I don't see the lobby for that, no, because I see the lobby on my side as well as the other side seems to be mostly interested in raising money for their candidates rather than, sadly, in helping women and children in trouble.
Well, I mean, I don't think that anybody could say that, you know, Planned Parenthood of America isn't interested in, I mean, you know, they have certain positions and they feel like they have to.
I'm not really talking about Planned Parenthood. I think they do a great job.
Okay. You know, we didn't talk, maybe we should move on since I just realized we've been talking about this for like 40 minutes.
Okay.
So, well, okay, you had said you wanted to talk about Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I'm just so fascinated by, you know, Rush Limbaugh having become the permanent government for the conservatives, for the Republican Party. I mean, it's astonishing to me that, you know, they're so afraid of this guy and his 20 million listeners that they have really just doomed their own project of trying to broaden the base and trying to bring in some diverse voices. And this has got to be galling for Michael Steele. You know, he had this, what a missed opportunity for him. He could have had this great sister soldier moment of saying, yeah, what Rush Limbaugh does on the radio, this, as he rightly said, entertainer, I mean, the guy's a performance artist.
But the thing is, I don't think Michael Steele could have a sister soldier moment because what Bill Clinton did was he essentially said, you know, that the Democratic Party had been, you know, kind of captured by these extremist voices, even though Sister Soldier didn't really represent anyone.
Right.
But the fact is, Sister Soldier really didn't represent more than an infinitesimal part of the Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Party might have been hostage to a certain kind of political correctness, but it's not as if she was a popular figure or her views were popular at all. I mean, the Democratic Party...
But there was that perception that he very cannily responded to.
Right, there was a perception, but the difference is that I think in the Republican Party, the perception is correct. That is the Republican Party.
Well, that's not going to be a Republican Party that can win elections.
Right, which is, I think is great. But what I'm saying is that, you know, the Republican Party really is, they're, in a certain way, they're kind of a hostage to their own, the far right is a hostage to its own success, right? They set out to take over the party from within. You know, I mean, you especially see this with the religious right. I just wrote about this with regard to James Dobson retiring. You know, on the one hand, the old religious right is dead, right? James Dobson is gone. Jerry Falwell's dead. D. James Kennedy is dead. A lot of these people are, there's no kind of
leadership.
But
you're right, their philosophy has now dominated the party. I mean,
well, that's the thing. They're dead, but their work is done. They set out to take over the party, you know, precinct by precinct. They set out to train people like Sarah Palin to run for town council and then maybe to run for mayor. You know, and now that is a party. And so and it's a party that's, you know, convinced itself that it is a majority, you know, despite kind of all evidence to the contrary. So, you know, so they still believe that their real problem is that they've deviated and that they just need to kind of
become... That is astonishing to me. To hear somebody come on and say the problem, you know, to hear Jindal come on and say, government, get off our backs at this moment when we've never needed government more. Or
well,
to
could
say,
you imagine if you were an unemployed person in Louisiana?
Right, to say, I don't want that unemployment benefit to be continued. You know, wouldn't you riot against your governor in the streets?
Yeah, I would be out there with a pitchfork.
And to say that because Bush failed miserably to respond to Hurricane Katrina, oh, well, that's how government is. How self-fulfilling. And I just, the fact that that seems to be, they truly believe, a winning strategy to say now, you know, let the free market have its way. It's really stunning that this... you know, surplus of capitalism leading to nationalization of the banks, and they're still saying what we need are more tax cuts. it's to the, I don't think that they still see that anything needs to be changed. I see nothing different happening from the Bush years, other than that now they're trying to paint Bush in retrospect as some kind of socialist.
Which is amazing. I mean, there's this kind of it's almost Stalinist the way they are. Right? I mean, did you hear that stuff from CPAC where they would talk about the Bush Obama program?
Right, right. And the terrible, you know, Bush stimulus.
I mean, I used to go to CPAC. I think I went 3 or 4 times during the Bush administration. You know, when they had these kind of Bush in a flight suit action figures, and there was this kind of totally insane cult of personality that was like something out of like Kazakhstan or something.
That's right. No, it's completely revisionist. I didn't hear anybody on the right saying this at the time. I mean, conservatives I know would sometimes say, if anything, he's too nice. He's too, you know, he's too lovely with the Democrats. But there was not this kind of criticism. But as you say, if they're determined to keep marching in this direction, they will be the minority party for a long time.
Which I'm also pretty thrilled to finally see our side, my side, learn how to play this game. You know, learn how to, you know, because you remember the Republicans always kind of sticking, always trying to make someone like Michael Moore or Sean
always
Penn.
Always being the Teddy Kennedy party, right? They won't say mm-hmm. that now because Teddy Kennedy is suddenly wildly popular.
Right.
But, yes.
Or Michael Moore.
Yes, I think, I know there's a lot of disagreement on this, but I think it's brilliant to set up Rush as the Republican king he wants to be, because he is not America.
Is there disagreement on it?
Yes, there is. There are a lot of people who say that that only builds him up and that we should ignore him and that we should, you know, that was a failed strategy for Robert Gibbs to mention him and Obama, and it would, you know, we should pretend he doesn't exist. I think we should continue to hang L. Rushbo around their necks if that's who their party wants to be. I mean, this is a guy who is race baiting constantly. You know, who never loses an opportunity to say the only possible, you know, people don't disagree with Obama because they're afraid to become,
right, 'cause I'm racist.
Yes, to be seen as racist. I mean, you know, who what's he call him? African American. I mean, who says some really offensive stuff, and you know, that's their base. That's if that's really who they want to be. I don't see that that's anything other than good for Democrats to continue to do that.
And to me, I think the most kind of significant, the most important thing is that really is who they are. I mean, that really is what the party has become.
That's who their base is. I'm sure there are many, many Republicans who are completely appalled by that. There are many, you know, Main Street Republicans who would not be, you know,
mainstream members of the party, but I don't know about mainstream members of Congress. I mean, most of the people who represented them have been knocked off. There's no Northeastern Republicans in Congress anymore. You know, there's been this kind of like systematic decimation of the moderate wing of the party.
And I think that Obama's back to our other issue, but you know, Obama, the more he can take these wedge issues off the table by bringing people together on those issues, that's the only thing they had going for them. And I think going forward, you know, they seem to continue to think that gay marriage is a big issue for them too. But every poll you look at says that, you know, younger voters don't see it that way. And, you know, voters in general will be seeing it that way less and less. With everything that's happened now, I don't think that's, you know, going to be a major focus for the moderate voter. So,
and then the other issue in which Obama seems to be that we were going to talk about, that Obama is very kind of cannily walking. Well, I don't know if it's, and I think both of us have mixed feelings about, both of us have mixed feelings about Obama, you know,
strategy
staying in Iraq a little bit longer, and also, you know, kind of
ramping up
in Afghanistan.
Right. I do have really mixed feelings on it because, you know, like him, I never thought I never saw the rationale for going into Iraq, but we're there now. And, you know, I have Republican friends who are very worried about Obama saying, you know, he's going to snatch those troops out of there in a minute. It's going to be very dangerous. And I guess it comes down to an issue of trust. You know, I trust Obama that if he says we can't do it safely in less in fewer than 19 months, then I believe him in a way that, you know, I never had confidence in the Bush administration.
That's right. Well, it's trust and it's also motive. I mean,
right.
I never believed that Bush wanted to get out. You know, and so
he looked at other options before we went in.
Right.
I never believed there was anything like a compelling argument to go in. But I'm wondering, I'd love to see whether those Republicans who were very worried about Obama, you know, pulling the troops out in 2 minutes, whether they feel a little bit better about this strategy. And I think there again, that's just the differences between the two policies now that he's president don't seem to be that different. I wish he could move more quickly because I don't think anything's gained by us staying there. I don't think that it'll be, I think it probably will be a bloodbath when we leave. And I know they're saying it won't be, but I'm not sure how much we've achieved there. And I don't know how much we'd achieve there if we stayed there forever. And I really feel the same way about Afghanistan. I think you can really say that Karzai is still the mayor of Kabul. I mean, I don't know what kind of progress can there, and maybe that makes me a defeatist Democrat, but I just don't think it's worth the lives and the money we put into it. And so am I, you know, I'm not furious with Obama because I trust him to do the best he can to get us out as quickly as possible, but I understand why some anti-war voices on the left are feeling betrayed by. Because what he's doing does.
I do too, although I also think that, I mean, it's not, if the difference of a few months means both that he can, you know, kind of listen to his military advisors, create a kind of consensus so that we don't have, I mean, we're going to inevitably have this kind of Dolchloss, you know, stab in the back. Mm-hmm. Rhetoric dominating our politics for the foreseeable future when things do go to hell in Iraq, as they almost certainly will in one way or the other.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I do trust him to kind of, if he feels like he has to do it a little bit more gradually, and that's actually a weird and maybe unhealthy position for journalists to be in. I trust the government to do what's right.
That's a new one, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, even saying it feels somehow like kind of corrupt.
But, and it's so, we're so unaccustomed. I mean, I think after the last 8 years, you know, when I did a book on women voters that came out in 07, and after the 04 election, I was surprised that the gender gap had narrowed slightly. So I wanted to hear from these women out in America who had switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican. And, mm-hmm. you know, over and over I heard women say that, you know, they thought he was a good man and they trusted him to do the right things, to do the right thing. And you'd think, wow, trusting the government, that's so different. But now, yes. Amazingly, I feel
right. Well, people would say that. Well, I think he's a good man. You know, he's
like, here I am saying I think Obama's a good man. Yeah. So,
but Afghanistan is so much trickier because although on the one hand you're right, there's this sense that we're slouching into this situation that is some, you know, kind of hideous amalgam of, I don't know, LBJ going into Vietnam and the Russians, you know, kind of getting into this war that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. At the same time, what can we do? I mean, what country would say, okay, we're going to stand back and let the Taliban reconstitute itself?
I think
you know, we're going to let this become a base to challenge
right.
the you know, kind of already teetering civilian government of Pakistan. I mean, it's such a mess. There's no even remotely good option.
There's not. I think the only thing we can do that we know works is the slow solution that we've never been really committed to, which is supporting development in those places. Mm-hmm. That's what works, but, you know, we haven't been willing to try that over time. And the way we went into Afghanistan before, initially, was the worst possible way. You know, go in, clean it out, leave. That was never going to work. And I agree with Obama that, you know, if anything, I would have liked to have seen that support there rather than Iraq, which is only the center of the war on terror because we made it that.
Because we made it that, yeah.
Right. But, yeah, it's amazing to now be feeling like, over to you, sir.